Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Miracle, there's a line open to start an hour with Jimmy Akin. One line open, 888-318-7884. You're like, well, I don't know what to ask him. Well, you can ask him anything because it's an Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. I just mentioned to one of our callers last hour, among Jimmy's books, the Bible is a Catholic book, A Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist, The Fathers Know Best. There's a lot of them. And you can check them all out at shop.catholic.com or wherever you get your good Catholic books. Jimmy, also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where today a new episode dropped and I am now in a time warp. I don't want to say it because I might have the 4th of July one in my brain because we pre-recorded.
Today was St. Malachy's Prophecy of the Popes.
Oh, yes. St. Malachy's Prophecy of the Pope. And Jimmy will reveal when the earth is going to end. I might be overselling that. There might be slight overselling in that. He will not be revealing when the earth is going to end.
I'm not allowed to tell.
Wait a second. That implies 888-318-7884.
Allowed to because I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other than in the future, which we established last
hour. That's right. We've divided the history into thirds, and we know which third it comes in. But other than that, and it's strange to make the present a third because is the present a third?
Yeah, I didn't endorse that.
You just endorse that construct.
It's two halves separated by an infinitesimal.
Yeah, yeah. Edgar has a new infinitesimal. Emiliano, little baby Emiliano. All right, let's go to Drew in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, listening on, and this is really what's written here, radio. All right.
Oh, boy.
That's a lot of information. Do you happen to know what station you're listening on, Drew, or no? No? Oh, sorry, Drew. I pushed the wrong button. Hey, Drew, do you know what station you're listening on?
I'm not exactly sure. I'm on a trip right now. But
oh, I'm glad you found Catholic Radio.
Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
All right.
Yeah. Well, I'm a frequent listener, so thank you for having me on.
Well, we're glad you're here. I think it's Holy Family Radio. That's who I think is in Harrisburg. So you're probably listening.
Yeah, that sounds right.
All right. Well, we're glad to have you. Drew, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, what I wanted to know is I'm new to the Catholic Church, and I'm very much into the paranormal investigations. But what I want to know is after you die, do you just go to heaven or hell, or is there a purgatory on earth? And if so, is that where we could find ghosts?
Okay, so we don't know a huge amount about the intermediate state between death and resurrection because God hadn't told us much about it. And what we do have are principally hints and indicators, but because of how little we know, we have to proceed with some caution here, and we shouldn't take particular images that we have from you know, the Bible or from later Christian art as literally true. I mean, for one thing, you know, they depict people as having bodies in the intermediate state. But Psychelet, are we going to have bodies in the intermediate state when our bodies are dead?
No, the resurrection of the dead comes later.
Right. So these kind of images are accommodated to our present understanding. So we have to be kind of careful here. Now, some of that caution was reflected, from a Catholic point of view, in a set of audiences that Pope John Paul II gave back in the late 1990s, where he talked about really heaven is its essence is union with God rather than being a physical place that people go. And in the same way, the essence of hell is separation from God rather than being a physical place that people go. And purgatory is a purification that happens for people who are on their way to full spiritual union with God, so on their way to heaven. And so when you understand those essences of heaven, hell, and purgatory, it really doesn't tell you anything about how they map onto physical space, or even do they map onto physical space. And so the Christian faith really doesn't have anything to say about that. And that allows us to then look at empirical data and say, well, what are the experiences that people have suggest? And there are numerous accounts in Christian history of people encountering souls here on earth. They at least seem to manifest here on earth. And in the case of many of those souls, they are experiencing a purgatory. They're experiencing a purification. And so you'll find, I mean, to give like one example kind of off the top of my head, there was a nun who had been inattentive in, like, say, in the prayers that she was supposed to pray in the chapel at her monastery. And so after she died, her fellow nuns would see her. They'd have a visual apparition of the deceased nun in the chapel saying her prayers. And they interpreted this, or this was interpreted as being, well, she kind of slacked off on this duty during life. So part of her purification involves making that right. So she kind of didn't say her prayers then, so now she's saying her prayers in the chapel now. And who knows what literally was happening, but that's at least how it was perceived and understood. And so I have no problem at all saying that, you know, God does allow departed spirits to interact with humans. When that happens with saints, you know, it's often celebrated, but it also happens with just ordinary souls that are not yet in full heavenly glory. You know, after-death communications are actually a very, very common phenomenon. We tend not to talk about them these days in our culture. People used to in our culture talk about them a lot. But then after the Protestant Reformation, it became taboo to talk about, in English-speaking lands, it became taboo to talk about seeing ghosts. And there are even histories of ghost encounters where they'll talk about the fact that it was really the Protestant Reformation that caused the taboo, and it actually didn't work. People were still seeing the ghosts. They just didn't feel free to talk about them anymore because Protestantism didn't want to talk about ghosts being purified on their way to heaven. But that was the standard Christian understanding of what a ghost was for, you know, 1,500 years. So these after-death communications still occur today. About 40% of the global population reports having at least one after-death communication with a departed friend or loved one at some point during their lives. So these are very, very common experiences that people have. And there have been statistical studies of, well, when they happen, you know, what does a person experience? Do they see a visual apparition? Do they have an auditory, meaning a hearing-based apparition? Is it an olfactory apparition? Do they smell something that was connected with the departed loved one? Like, you know, you smell your grandmother's perfume, or you smell your grandfather's pipe tobacco, or whatever it may be. And in the case of the more robust apparitions, where they say hear a voice or see a visual apparition that then is able to communicate with them, they've classified the messages that are communicated, and they tend to fall into about four major categories. But the types of messages include things like, I'm fine, don't worry, don't grieve for me. They also include things like, I love you. They include things like, please forgive me, you know, for something that they had done during life. And they include things like, please pray for me. And so those please forgive me and please pray for me messages would suggest that the person is undergoing purgatory and they're still being purified. That's why they want forgiveness from someone, and that's why they want prayer from someone. So we do have empirical evidence that is consistent with the idea of some souls are experiencing purgatory and they're able to manifest here on earth as part of that. So does that help you out, Drew? Now, I should mention, on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, I did some episodes on after-death communications, and I can get you the numbers for that. You might want to look at episodes 306 and 307. They're both about after-death communications. You can get to them by going to mysterious.fm/306 and mysterious.fm/307. So that's kind of a basic sketch, but is there more you wanted to ask about that?
No, that's actually a lot of what I was looking for. I never totally understood what it was saying before this. I've always wondered, though, if they went straight to heaven and it was something to be maybe scared of because they weren't good souls, maybe I thought, if they didn't make it straight to heaven.
No, souls who are in purgatory are holy souls. That's actually what they're called, the holy souls. They died in God's friendship. They are fundamentally good. You do not need to be scared of a soul in purgatory.
Drew, I'm going to leave it there and say thanks, because we got to take a break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
We should pray because prayer is conversation with God, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship. We need that relationship with God. We should pray and talk with God about what's on our hearts, what's on our minds, what's active in our lives, the joys we have. We should share all of these with God. Prayer is conversation, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship with God. It's the most important relationship. All of our other relationships depend on this one.
Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. It's Ask Me Anything, and lots of folks on the lines. So back to the phones we go. Andrea's in San Antonio, Texas. Andrea, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with the question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. In the Bible, when it says, "At the name of Jesus, every knee shall bend, above the earth, on the earth, and under the earth." I'm having a hard time understanding under the earth. Like, wouldn't that be hell? And I understand above the earth, of course, in heaven, and on earth, people, you know, bowing down to Jesus, you know, in worship, you know, because they're not with God yet. But under the earth and hell, how does that... I can't connect the two, because it seems like hell's already, you know, somebody's already gone to hell. And, if the master of the underworld is Satan, how could Satan allow that?
Okay, so first of all, I'll answer the question on the assumption that it is talking about hell, meaning the place of the damned. And then I'll back up and propose some alternative understandings. On the assumption that we're talking about heaven, meaning the place of the righteous, blessed, and the angels, the good angels, and then the earth, and then the hell of the damned, meaning damned angels and damned humans. Well, what this passage would be inferring is that at some point in the future, God is going to make everyone recognize the lordship of him and Christ, and so that's going to include That's going to include damned angels and damned humans, that they will have to just recognize God is ultimately Lord. He wins in the end. And so all the rebellion that people did against God during their lives and all the rebellion that fallen angels did prior to the last judgment, well, everyone, including the fallen angels, they're going to face the last judgment. And they will have to recognize the ultimate lordship of God at that point. And so they may not be happy about it, but they'd at least be forced to recognize it. And so that's one way of understanding the passage, on the assumption that the passage is talking about the hell of the damned. But there are other ways to understand it. And here we have a choice to make depending on how the biblical author, which in this case is St. Paul, this is in Philippians 2:10, if people want to look it up, but how St. Paul is conceptualizing the structure of the universe. Now, it's clear that in this passage, he's using a tripartite or three-part structure for the universe. You've got above the earth, and below the earth. The question is, what is in those zones? Now, we have a pretty good idea what's on the earth. We know about that. And we can make some reasonable inferences about what's above the earth. You know, that's where God's throne is, the way Paul is conceptualizing this, even though God doesn't physically have a throne. That's how he's conceptualizing it. And, you know, the good angels are up there. But what's below the earth? Well, there's a couple of options. In some ancient Near Eastern texts, the universe was conceptualized so that the earth was floating on top of a subterranean ocean. And so if that's the case, then below the earth is not talking about hell. It's talking about the subterranean ocean and all the creatures that are in the subterranean ocean, that, you know, the fish and the octopuses and the sea monsters and everything. They're all going to praise God too. They're all going to acknowledge God's lordship and Jesus's lordship. But the texts that do that tend to be like 1,000 years before St. Paul's time. And you don't have as much of this perception of the world or conceptualization of the world as involving a subterranean ocean in St. Paul's day. Instead, the underworld had come to be understood as the place, not of the damned specifically, but of the place of the dead in general, because in Hebrew culture, in Israelite culture, you buried people in the earth. Now, you might do that by having them go sideways into a cave tomb, but frequently you had them go down into a burial pit tomb, which is actually what we do today. We dig these little pits and we put coffins in them, and so we also put people in the earth to bury them, and they did that too. So down became not just a symbol of where the damned went, it became a symbol of the place where the dead went. And so it's possible that, and I think this is the more likely interpretation of the three I've named, that St. Paul is envisioning the angels and the heavenly creatures as praising God and acknowledging Jesus's lordship, and the people who are alive here on earth as praising God and acknowledging Jesus's lordship, and also the dead praising God and acknowledging Jesus's lordship. So this is a symbol of how all creatures, heavenly ones, earthly ones, and deceased earthly ones, are all going to acknowledge Jesus's lordship when it comes to the final day. So that's how I take the passage. I think that's the most likely of the three interpretations.
Okay. Alrighty. It's just because I was wondering about that too. If somebody is gone, mm-hmm. they're already gone. So they're not in their physical body anymore, but their deceased body would still bend, like their knee would bend.
This is something we have to. So St. Paul does not think that, you know, in tombs that people's knees are going to be that their leg muscles are going to be contracting to bend their knees. This could be after the resurrection, and thus it could involve physical kneeling. for everybody in a resurrected state. And he's just identifying the places where these people came from. You know, some were alive at the time of the second coming. Others were in their graves, but then they were resurrected. But he's still speaking of them as things under the earth, because that's where they are now, even though that's not where they'll be on Judgment Day. That's one possibility. I think, though, we shouldn't necessarily interpret this too literally. What bending the knee means is acknowledging Jesus's lordship, because you kneel in front of a Lord. And so all he really means is all creatures are going to acknowledge. And here that could just mean all of the saved, and he's just ignoring the damned for these purposes. But it could literally mean all creatures, saved and damned, are going to acknowledge Jesus's lordship, but we shouldn't assume that that means they're going to be physically bending their knees.
Andrea, thank you very much for the call. On we go to Stephen in Chicago, Illinois, listening on iTunes. Glad you're here, Stephen. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was listening to this Theology of the Body course recently, and I heard this quote that I enjoyed very much, but I am not so confident on it. So if I can get some clarifications on it, that would be awesome. So the quote is from St. John Paul II, and it is, "A greater good is maintained when someone uses his freedom wrongly than when he is forced to do what is good."
Okay.
And it was offered in the context of if your children would like to be more independent, you could preach the truth of what they should be doing, but you shouldn't impose on them. So I like this idea very much. But for example, if we think of the policemen, right? So they are all the time stopping other people from using their freedom wrongly, and the greater good is achieved. So My question is, why is this quote true, or what the John Paul II meant by it, and what are the limits? So when not a greater good is achieved?
Okay, so I haven't heard this Theology of the Body course you're talking about, and I am not familiar with this quote, so I don't know what context it appeared in, and I don't know what John Paul, I don't know for sure what John Paul II would have been saying, or whether he would have been right. You know, he wrote the Theology of the Body is actually not something that was part of his pontifical magisterium. It's based on stuff that he wrote before he was Pope, and thus it doesn't carry magisterial authority. At least in its historical roots form, it doesn't. But I can see that there is an element of truth here. At least I can see how one would defend the quote and say, well, look, even if what ultimately is people need to do is they need to use their free will, and they need to be trained in a way that they use their free will correctly. And thus there is an element of benefit when someone is using their will freely rather than under compulsion. And even if they're using it wrong, at least they're using their freedom. And there's an element of truth there that that's better than just forcing them to do something. I'm having to rely on your quotation of it because I don't have the quote in front of me and I haven't been able to look up its context. But based on the way you've articulated it, I would say I can see an element of truth here. But obviously, if that's what's meant, it's not unlimited, because John Paul II knows and himself endorsed the idea of civil law is also needed, and we need law enforcement agencies to promote the common good of society. So even though there may be a good that is present when someone misuses their freedom as opposed to being forced to do a good thing, that's not an unlimited good that can't be trumped by other considerations. And so let's take an example, murder. Well, okay, murder involves the misuse of free will, but that doesn't mean you don't stop a murderer. It doesn't mean we don't need police to stop murderers. It doesn't mean that that you know ordinary citizens shouldn't step forward to stop murderers. We need to stop murderers. And so whatever truth John Paul II was articulating here is one that has circumscribed limits. Now, I could go further and speculate on this and what he may have meant, but I'm afraid I really don't. I hesitate to do that since I can't look up the quote and see it in its original context. So I think that's about the most I can do with it without being able to look up the original context. I think there's an element of truth here, but it also has clear limits. Exactly what those limits are would depend on what type of good John Paul II is talking about here. But I need to see the passage in its original context to really speak further to that.
Stephen, thank you very much for the call. All the lines continue full, so we know we've got lots more questions for Jimmy to come, which is good because we've got a half hour more of this program. It's Catholic Answers Live. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. More to come right after this. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. A little bit of Friday groovy music for you. Also some Friday Jimmy Akin and some Friday Ask Me Anything. And every single line full. Back we go to the phones. Andy's in Long Beach, California, watching on YouTube. Glad you're here, Andy. You got a question for Jimmy?
Hi there. Yes, afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Lately, I find it pretty common when I hear Catholic conversion stories, people bring up the fact that, you know, when they read the Bible with early church fathers, that it sort of makes sense of the Bible. And so my question is, you know, basically, who are all these early church fathers that all these Catholic converts seem to be reading with the Bible that sort of clears up the Bible and, you know, turns them Catholic? And, you know, I want to read these guys, you know, and I just don't know who or where to find our writings or what writings. And so, yeah.
Okay, so the early church fathers were a group of early Christian authors who were Orthodox in their faith, and they so they weren't like heretics. In the West, they're reckoned as stretching from the late first century, so the end of the Apostolic Age, through the mid 600s. And in the East, they're reckoned as stretching from the end of the Apostolic Age through the mid 700s. Saint Isidore of Seville is considered the last one in the West, and Saint John of Damascus is considered the last one in the East. After that, you have medieval figures who aren't classified as church fathers. In terms of their writings, well, there's a bunch of them. They wrote a lot over the course of the first, you know, 600 or 700 years. And a lot of these writings are published in big, huge sets that actually are available. The classic set is, or group of sets, is by an editor named Minya, who has a Latin set and a Greek set and a Syriac set of writings of the fathers in this period. But like I said, it's in Latin, Greek, and Syriac. So unless you speak those languages, you're probably going to want to be working in translation. If you do speak those languages, they're available for free on Google Books because they're public domain. Most of the people you've been hearing about, I assume, are reading them in translation. And there are a variety of different translations. I know when I was in the process of becoming Catholic, or actually before that process started, I read an edition of some of the earliest church fathers called Early Christian Writings. It was edited by a man named Maxwell Staniforth. It was published by Penguin Press. And when I read it, it's like, these guys are not sounding Protestant. You know, they're sounding pretty Catholic. And that kind of was one of the stepping stones on my journey towards the Catholic Church. But after I became Catholic, I ended up editing a column and eventually producing a book called The Fathers Know Best that goes into who the fathers were. It's got individual biographies of them, talks about them more generally, and it has excerpts from the writings of the fathers on almost 50 different topics. And it shows how you can trace from early days to later days things that the Catholic Church teaches today. So what I'd suggest, Cy, is that we see if we can get Andy's address and send him a copy of The Fathers Know Best.
Andy, hang on. Give us that address and we'll send it to you. That's easy enough to do. Thank you very much for the call and for the question. I'm going to pick up my speed a little bit because all these phone lines are filled. Felix is in Jacksonville, Florida, watching on YouTube. Hey, Felix, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Jimmy, for answering my question. So I'm a Protestant studying Catholic theology right now, and I am aware that Catholics believe that the apostolic deposit of faith is finalized, that the biblical canon has closed, and that public revelation has ceased. But I'm struggling to connect that, the dots between that, and the idea that doctrine can develop over time and can be defined by the church in, you know, dogmas and various statements. And so I was wondering if you could kind of compare and contrast those ideas and kind of help me connect the dots.
Okay. So, Cy Kellett, I'm going to rely on you for some help in answering this question. Is there such a shape in geometry known as a triangle?
Yes, there is. Oh, I got that one. Let's just stop there. I'm doing good.
Let's keep going and see how well you do. Have there been any new shapes in geometry invented that are like a triangle that have not always existed in principle?
No.
So the body of geometrical shapes, even if humans haven't found them all, the body of geometrical shapes that's been given to mankind is closed. You know, they all exist in principle. And even if we hadn't discovered one, it's still there implicitly in geometry. We just haven't fleshed it out yet.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Right.
Okay. Now, one of the things which the Scarecrow actually misquotes in the movie version of The Wizard of Oz is the Pythagorean theorem. The Pythagorean theorem is the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the square of the other two sides. Or a squared plus b squared equals c squared, taking c as the hypotenuse. So that's the Pythagorean theorem understood correctly. Cy Kellett, who would you guess?
Oh, I know this one.
Invented the Pythagorean theorem?
Pythagoras.
Well, that's a good guess, but that's not actually accurate because the Pythagorean, he's commonly credited with it, but it actually was known a long time before Pythagoras. Hmm. But would the Pythagorean theorem have been known since the dawn of human history?
No, they didn't do very much geometry early on.
Okay, so all of the shapes in geometry have existed since the dawn of human history, but the Pythagorean theorem was not known until later in human history. Would you say that's accurate?
That is. I feel like I some of these might be trick questions, but I'm going to go yes, that's accurate.
No, they're not trick questions.
The Pythagoras
ones. Well, a little bit. okay, so you can have a closed body of data that nevertheless you can later, based on reflection on that data, realize a new insight. Just like people had known about triangles long before the Pythagorean theorem was discovered. And then at some point, someone based on reflecting on the nature of triangles realized this relationship between the hypotenuse and the other two sides. So this is a direct comparison to the deposit of faith, which is closed, and how doctrine develops. You know, it's like we already knew the basic facts about triangles, like they have three sides and three angles. That's why they're called triangles. But we didn't yet know the implicit fact that there's a relationship between the hypotenuse and the other two sides that can be articulated in the Pythagorean theorem. So that was a development based on our earlier, simpler understanding of triangles. So the basic geometrical facts about triangles were already known. And that was, you know, there hadn't been any new facts about triangles invented. But based on reflecting on what the basic nature of triangles is, we can later arrive at new insights. And the same thing is true when it comes to doctrinal development. So, for example, the deposit of faith that comes to us from Christ and the apostles indicates that Jesus is fully God. He's not lacking anything, you know, that you need to be God. And he's fully man. He's not lacking anything that you need to be a man. Well, okay, those are items that are taught in the deposit of faith. But it took a few centuries for people to realize, oh, well, if Jesus is fully God, that must mean he has a divine will. And if he's fully man, that must mean he has a human will. So he must have two wills, a divine will and a human will. And that position is known as diotheletism, duo meaning two in Greek and thelema meaning will. So diotheletism means Christ has two wills. But even though the implicit basis for that is there in the deposit of faith from the first century, it took time for people to put the pieces together and figure out, oh, well, then diotheletism must be true. And so that's an illustration of how all of the basic data has already been given, but people can realize new insights based on that data. It's kind of like you have a certain number of mathematical axioms, like Euclid's, you know, five axioms of geometry, but then it may take time for you to make all the proofs that Euclid was able to do with his five axioms. So, Felix, does that help you out? Does that help clarify things?
It very much does. It gives me a lot to reflect on. And so, kind of using another example, what I hear you saying, and I think this is an important distinction for me, you know, for instance, Catholics are not arguing that, like, the fullness of every doctrine was fully understood by believers in the first century. So, for example, Irenaeus probably didn't understand, like, transubstantiation, for instance, but he did understand the real presence. And by Aquinas' later reflecting on that, he was able to draw out new insights on how that can be possible. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, that's basically what I'd be saying. Uh-huh.
Felix, thanks. I got to take a break. Thanks very much for that. I'm going to find out. Go ahead.
First, though, Felix, I want to recommend a book for you.
Okay.
It's an essay on the development of Christian doctrine by Cardinal John Henry Newman. That's the classic work on this. He gives lots of historical examples. Also, I have a book called Teaching with Authority, where I cover this and other aspects of Catholic teaching. And since you're here in the United States, if you'll hang on the line, we'll see if we can get your address and send you a copy, at least, of Teaching with Authority.
Hang on. We would love to do that. We do have to take this break. Right back with more Euclidean geometry. Who's the founder of Euclid? Is it Euclid?
Euclid.
Okay. Oh, you say that like it's obvious, but that's what I thought about Pythagoras. All right, right back with more Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
This is Father Dwight Longenecker. Catholic Radio helps to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ around the world in the fullness of the Catholic faith, with sound teaching, orthodox theology, reverent worship. EWTN is doing the very best work we can to spread the fullness of the faith in the Catholic Church throughout the whole world.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything, and lots of folks have decided to take Jimmy up on that offer to ask him anything. So we will go right back to the phones. Let's see. I think I got a little confused. Am I going to Trevor in Omaha, Nebraska? I apologize, Trevor. Got myself a little crossed up there. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Trevor? I pushed the right button. I pushed the Trevor button. Trevor's on mute. Hi, Trevor. You got a question?
Hey. Yes. Oh, okay. So.
Right into the phone, Trevor. You don't have a great connection, so right into the phone.
Yes.
Oh, Trevor, I don't know if you're driving. Hang on. I'm going to come back to you. I'm going to come back to you, Trevor. It's just the connection's terrible at the moment. We can't hear you. Let's go to New York City. New York City. Frank in New York City. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, thank you, fellas. God bless you. I just want to endorse, I have Jimmy's book, The Fathers Know Best, and it's a wonderful book. I would recommend that to anybody.
Thank you.
Like you mentioned before, on that topic.
That's very nice, Frank.
Yes, God bless. My question is, as I understand it, the question of the Second Coming and the Rapture, what the Protestants call the Rapture of the Church, the Rapture could happen at any moment, and there's a seven-year tribulation period at which, at the end of that, the second coming of Christ happens. I think the Catholic Church's teaching is that the second coming and the resurrection of the dead, which is essentially the rapture, happen virtually at the same time, at the end of the tribulation. And what I would like to do, I have a couple of verses of scripture that I want to bounce off you, Jimmy, but I could you give me some solid evidence for the Catholic position on that, on what we believe?
Okay, so to deal with this part of your question, I would note that belief in the rapture is not a universal among Protestants, far from it. In fact, historically, no Protestants believed in the scenario that you just described. It Right. only began to be popular in some Protestant circles, particularly in the English-speaking world, in the 1820s. So basically, it's less than 200 years old, or just over 200 Right. years old. And even then, it tends to be in English-speaking areas, and particularly in the United States. But historically, this was not the view of any Protestants. It's a very recent phenomenon. But you're correct in your assessment that the Catholic Church understands the event that's referred to in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, where the dead who are newly resurrected and the believers who are alive at the time are caught up to be with Jesus, that occurs at the second coming, not several years before a 1,000-year period before the end of the world, but right at the end of the world. I recently did an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World where I did a deep dive into the rapture. And since we're getting kind of close to the end of the show today, and you said you had a couple of verses you wanted to ask me about, what I would do is suggest that you go listen to the episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on the rapture. It's a really deep dive. I go into a bunch of stuff. It's episode 357. So you can get to it by going to mysterious.fm, like FM radio, /357. You could also go to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. And in the search bar for my channel, as opposed to the search bar for YouTube itself, you can search on the word rapture and it'll come up.
Okay, Frank.
Frank, you had a couple of verses you wanted to ask me about.
They're very obvious. 1 Corinthians 15:52 says, at the last trumpet, the dead will rise. At the last trumpet. And if you compare that with Matthew 24, verses 29 and down, it says, after the tribulation of those days, the Son of Man will appear in the sky, which has got to be the second coming, right? And with the sound of a great trumpet. But it can't be the last trumpet, as mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15:52. I mean, could I use those verses? Because they contradict each other as far as Protestant theology is concerned.
Well, I mean, you can use any verses you want, but I don't know that I would use them in that way. I think there are other more profitable ways of showing that the event that's described in 1 Thessalonians 4:17 occurs at the end of the world and not several years before a 1,000-year reign of Christ before the end of the world. Those passages are actually in the Thessalonian letters themselves, particularly in 2 Thessalonians, where Paul clarifies what he was talking about in 1 Thessalonians. The reason I wouldn't use these is that I think that there is some merit to the 1 Thessalonians 15 verse in that Paul does say last, and that suggests that it's at the end of the world. I can imagine, though, how a rapture believer would get around that. They would say, well, he's just talking about the last trumpet before the rapture. That's not to say there may not be other trumpets. And then when it comes to Matthew 24, I think that the bulk of Matthew 24 is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in the first century, because that's the question that kicks off the discussion, is when is the temple going to get destroyed? And that happened in AD 70. I think that by Matthew 25, that version of the Olivet Discourse, it's called that because it took place on the Mount of Olives, transitions to using parables about the second coming. That's Matthew 25, though. In Matthew 24, at least the majority of the information is about a coming of Christ in judgment on Jerusalem in AD 70. And so I would tend not to rely, and it's not entirely clear in Matthew where the break is between the material that deals with AD 70 and the material that deals with the second coming. But there was a coming of Christ in judgment on Jerusalem, a spiritual coming in AD 70. And so I would tend not to appeal to Matthew 24 to get exact chronologies about what's going to play out at the end of the world, because it's not clear where the dividing line is.
Right. Oh, well, that sounds great, Jimmy. I thank you. You know, I'm always in discussions with Protestants. I'm an apologist myself, not on that level, but, you know, I do the best I can. And
Good.
They're always trying to tear down the Catholic Church one way or another, so I'm trying to be as accurate as possible, you know.
Yeah, and that's in, it's great you're thinking about these things. It's great you're thinking about what do these different passages mean and how can they be used apologetically. And it's great that you're trying to be as accurate as possible. So my compliments to you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank. I'm just going to keep moving, try to get as many on as I can before we have to go shortly here. Lanisha in Pensacola, Florida, listening on Spotify. You are next, Lanisha. Go ahead with your question.
Hello, how are we doing?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. I was at a daily mass, and a young lady went to receive communion, and when she did, she kneeled, and the priest told her, no, get up, and made her get up to receive standing, and then she went back to the pew just crying. I thought the germ allowed for receiving kneeling if you choose.
Yep, it does.
Oh.
Yeah, I would say this priest, unless there were special circumstances, like this lady was about to trip somebody, then what this priest did was entirely unwarranted, out of compliance with the church's liturgical law, and frankly, he was being a jerk.
Lanisha,
okay.
I feel like you might have suspected that.
I did, but I wasn't really sure, and I want to privately talk to him, but I'm not sure if it would be even warranted.
Well, that's a judgment call.
Other things that have happened.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
That's a judgment call. But if you wanted to talk to him about it and you're in a position to do so, you know, you could you can get the quotation from the germ about this in the version of the germ that's, for people who may not be familiar, the germ, G-I-R-M, it's not G-E-R-M, it's G-I-R-M. That stands for General Instruction of the Roman Missal. And it's the introductory document that contains the basic rules that are used at Mass. And there's a special edition of it for the United States, and that special edition addresses this subject and indicates that the faithful can receive kneeling, I mean, apart from bizarre circumstances like you just tripped somebody. But it indicates that they can. And you could get that quotation from the current edition of the germ, which came out in the year 2010, and show it to the priest and say, you know, you sent that woman back to her seat crying. You could easily alienate her from the church with your actions, and you need to follow what's here in the germ and not impose your own ideas about what's preferable at Mass. The church has allowed her to receive kneeling if she chooses, and you need to allow it too.
Okay, Lanisha.
And then you can suppress your own thoughts about, you know, you don't have to say the part about you donkey hole. So,
Lanisha, I don't think you would say that anyways.
Be in a hole in which one puts donkeys.
You seem so nice, Lanisha. Thanks very much. Thanks for the call. I'll tell you what I'd like to send you because you seem very thoughtful about these things. Maybe I think you will like Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. If you just want to hang on and give us an address, I will send you that book. I want to try to get Colin in Plymouth, Michigan, who's listening on Ave Maria Radio there on the line. Colin, go ahead with your question.
Hey, Jimmy. Hey, Si. Thanks for taking my call. In paragraph Catechism 1472, it says, every sin entails an unhealthy attachment to creatures, which must be purified either here on earth or after death in a state called purgatory. This purification frees us from temporal punishment of sin. But in Catechism 1263, it says, baptism forgives all sins, original sin, as well as all punishment for sin. So my question is, does baptism free us from an attachment to sin? Because it seems like if an adult's baptized and commits sins habitually before, that he'll likely still have this attachment afterwards. So does baptism take away attachment to sin?
So it's going to depend on how you're defining attachment to sin, but basically the church acknowledges that baptism does not remove all temptation or tendency to sin. The language that historically has been used for this tendency is concupiscence. And so if you look up concupiscence in the catechism, you can see how it acknowledges, and it'll discuss this in the section on baptism, that baptism, I mean, it may diminish the amount of concupiscence we have, but it doesn't totally remove it. And so consequently, there are ongoing temptations that are part of the Christian life, and there's an ongoing tendency to sin that must be resisted and mastered over the course of the Christian life. And if that's not done completely by the end of the Christian life, then it'll happen in purgatory.
Colin, thanks. Thanks to those three callers that were leaving on the line as well. Lots of callers today. So we weren't able to get to you, but we do this every week. Hopefully we'll get to talk with you next week. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for 4 hours of hard work today, including two live with us right now.
My pleasure.
That will do it for us. We will see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.